Tonight, our special guest is Dean Radin. He is, of course, a very heavy hitter with the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Have you ever had that capability where you could sense what's happening to someone you care about thousands of miles away? How about the idea that you know who's about ready to call you, the phone rings, and it's that person? How do these intuitive hunches work? That's just one of the things we'll talk with Dean Radin about when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Dean Radin, Ph.D., is the laboratory director at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in California. He has worked at AT&T Bell Laboratories, GTE Laboratories on advanced telecommunication systems, and for nearly two decades, he has conducted research on psychic phenomena in academia, Princeton University, the University of Edinburgh, University of Nevada. In three Silicon Valley think tanks, and also, he worked at SRI International. He served as a scientist on a highly classified program investigating psi phenomena for the U.S. government. Dr. Radin is the author of The Conscious Universe and also what we're talking about tonight, Entangled Minds, right here on Coast to Coast. Hello, Dean. Welcome back. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you, George?
Good. My pleasure. What have you been doing lately besides writing, writing, and writing?
Being on talk shows.
Going all over?
Yes. It's part of pushing a book. So that's partly what I've been doing.
Dean, you know, some time ago, when you were on the program during the very horrible period of 9/11, and this is back several years, obviously, mm-hmm. but you talked about the Princeton eggs a lot. Has that continued, and is there anything new there in that arena?
The project has continued. It still consists of about 70 random number generators located around the world, and we continue to track worldwide events. We have 216 as of today. The last event that we looked at was Earth Day, April 22nd, and it resulted in a close to significant deviation. Other events that we've looked at include a bombing in Bali, the massive earthquake in Pakistan, that sort of thing. And as many of the experiments that we do, we're interested in what does the evidence look like cumulatively? What does it look like when we look at many events over a long period of time? And with these 216 events, the overall probability is about 400,000 to 1 at this point. So we're pretty confident that we're dealing with some real relationship between collective mind and a form of collective matter.
Dean, tell us about these 70 random generators. You know, a lot of new people jump on board this program, and they're probably saying, what are these? How do they work? Explain the mechanism behind them.
Okay. A random number generator is an electronic circuit that, in essence, is like an electronic coin flipper. It produces sequences of heads and tails in a completely random way, where the randomness can be traced down into the circuitry and ultimately down to individual quantum events. So it's not like oftentimes in computer games you'll find random-looking events, but those are based on algorithms, on software. These are based on actual physical noise. And the idea of it is that we have a hypothesis that there's a relationship between mind and matter. And the relationship is something like an equation where you have an equal sign in the middle and you have mind on one side, matter on the other. And if that hypothesis is true, then when one side of the equation changes, the other has to change. So what we look for then are large scale changes in the mind side of that equation. And then we look for changes, corresponding changes, in the matter side. And the matter that we use is random numbers, these random number generators.
Are these generators on all the time? Do they have to be turned on at a certain time?
No, they run 24 hours a day, every day. They send their data up through the Internet automatically. And the reason we built it this way, it's now going for 8 years continuously, is to take advantage of events that are unexpected, events like 9/11 and earthquakes and so on, to see what happens before, during, and after these events occur.
Dean, after 8 years, how accurate can you say to us tonight that without any doubt, when major events occur, you can see a spike with these generators?
All we can say is that for the 216 events that we've looked at so far, the odds against chance are strong enough to give us confidence that something is going on. For any particular event, any particular kind of event, we don't know. We don't know enough yet about why, what is it about a mental event that causes a change in randomness. But we know from looking at the entire set of events that something is definitely happening.
You've conducted experiments before with the generators. In your opinion, Dean, what has been the highest spike that is way beyond chance? In what event? Was it the 9/11 event?
Well, 9/11, of course, was especially meaningful on many different levels. So it's the event that we've looked at in most detail. And as a result, we know more about what was happening in the random network on that day than we do on any other day. And there were some very strange anomalies that occurred in the random network worldwide. So we're fairly confident that at least on that day that very strange things were happening in the environment, because these random generators essentially are detectors of entropy, of randomness in the environment, and they behaved in a less random fashion during that day. What we guess then is we have to make the inference that because the random generators were no longer acting random, that it's reflective of this order that was appearing in mind. Minds were certainly not random on that day.
Have you seen any spikes with days and events that didn't occur until much later? I guess my question is do you see the spikes happen when the event occurs, or do you sometimes see it as a predictor that you can see a spike maybe 1 or 2 days, maybe a week before an actual event occurs?
We haven't looked at that yet. We've looked only at a matter of hours in advance of the event. And it's not because we couldn't do it, but
sure,
simply the number of analysts available to look at the massive amount of data that we have. I think the total now is probably 10 gigabytes or more. So it just takes a long time to do an analysis of this type. Nevertheless, with a matter of hours before the events, one thing that we have discovered, and we first noticed it with 9/11, is roughly 3 hours before the first jet hit the World Trade Center, we noticed that there was a change in the worldwide network that was going in the direction that it would lead to a very significant statistical spike right around the time that the terrorism was unfolding. But we were able to see that about 3 hours before. So we've since gone back and looked at other kinds of impulse events. We call it an impulse event because it's something that's not predicted in advance and hits suddenly, and then everyone finds out about it quickly. So the other kind of event that we've looked at in some detail are earthquakes.
Uh-huh.
And with earthquakes, we find that there's about a three-hour change that occurs in the random network that corresponds to the earthquake itself. And what this gave us then was a way of testing what is it that we think is actually changing. Is it mind, or is it maybe picking up something physical in the environment?
Like a vibration or something.
Right. So the way we did it then is we went back through a couple of years' worth of earthquakes around the world and separated them into earthquakes that occurred around populated areas and earthquakes that occurred around non-populated areas, like the middle of the Pacific, and then did the analyses separately on those two blocks of data, and basically all of the effect occurs when they're around populated areas. So that suggests that we're dealing with something having to do with people.
Fantastic. I would guess that this three-hour window that you're beginning to see now in some of these cases, I wonder if that's the window that the animals, for example, on the tsunami that hit in the ocean, I wonder if they have this three-hour window, you know, because we hear that animals, birds, mm-hmm. get this feeling, and they're gone. And in this case, I mean, they took off. I wonder if it was a three-hour window there, or maybe more.
Yeah, with animals, it's a little bit more difficult because there are some physical correlates to earthquakes, like electromagnetic impulses and magnetic changes. And animals are very sensitive to that, and they may be reacting to changes in those fields. On the other hand, the random number generators, we know because of by the way they're designed that they're not influenced by changes in electromagnetism or magnetic fields. So there's something else besides the electromagnetic signals that animals may be responding to.
Now, these 70 generators, Dean, they are placed where? All over the planet or in just a few locations?
It roughly parallels where the Internet is. So there are quite a few in the United States, and there are quite a few in Europe. But we have, I think we have every other continent, I think maybe except for Antarctica. And it roughly, if you looked at a map of the density of the Internet, that's where they are.
In theory, because as we get into entangled minds and some of your thoughts about this, in theory, are locations even important if the mind can reach out probably throughout this universe because it's intertwined with so many different things? Uh-huh. Do we even have to worry about placement of the generators?
It's a very good question. One of the reasons that we have it distributed around the world is to ask that very question. So, for example, for 9/11, we looked at the correlations between the generators because, you know, if you just get a big statistical effect in a whole bunch of generators, that doesn't tell you what was going on in the individual generators.
Right.
So we looked at the relationship between every pair of generators. And what we're able to find was that, I'll use a metaphor to explain what happened here. It's as though you're looking for a tsunami. And so how would you detect that? You put buoys and you scatter them all over the ocean, and you monitor something like the height of each buoy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're able to translate the height into something like a tone, then most of the time you're going to hear noise because the heights of all of the generators, in this case buoys, are slightly different, and they just move around randomly, so you hear random tones. You know that a tsunami has taken place if suddenly the tones turn into a chord. And now they're all sort of going together. They're moving together because it means there's a gigantic wave in the water. So these generators, when we look at the correlations between them, we're able to see what looks like a giant wave in consciousness or a wave in entropy. And that's what these detectors are picking up, essentially.
And you've got that illustrated pretty well in Entangled Minds. In the case of 9/11, were generators that were placed closer to New York, wherever they were in the United States, for example,
mm-hmm.
did they register higher spikes than generators that were put in other countries?
Well, in a word, yes. The way that we analyzed it was to first separate the generators from the North and South Hemisphere, and then by continent, and then by coast on continent, and so on. And when you do that exercise, you find out that the East Coast of the United States was where most of the statistical deviation occurred. And, of course, that's quite an interesting result.
It is phenomenal, Dean.
It suggests that you may be able to use this network as a kind of predictive structure. And, I mean, it's abstract. It's not saying here's what the thing is going to occur in New York City. What it says is that a strange sort of non-random event is beginning to build in this particular area. And what it doesn't tell us, of course, is what it is.
And of course, you know, it's still in its infancy, 8 years old. Can equipment make it better? What could change this, which, you know, gets you the kind of data that you and the other people, and how many other people are working on the project?
Well, there's roughly 100 people involved in the project. Most of them are hosts of the random generators. We call them EGGS, by the way, or EGG stands
right
for electrogyogram. And the word is a takeoff on electroencephalogram because of the idea that just like on the head, if you wanted to pick up what's going on in the brain, you put electrodes all around the head and it picks up the electrical impulses. Well, these generators are like putting the equivalent of an electrode all around Gaia's head. Gaia means the planet.
The planet, exactly.
So we're picking up Gaia's electroencephalogram. We call them electrogaiagrams, just for fun. So about 100 hosts of these eggs, and only about 6 analysts. And, of course, the director is Roger Nelson at Princeton.
Right.
So there's been a small group of people that's been dealing with this, and we do the best we can.
Will technology make this better?
We think so. Like, one of the things that we're working on now is a parallel network. This is to help test that that the experimenters are not somehow, that our minds are not producing the effect. So we would like a completely parallel network of additional random number generators that other analysts look at, especially other analysts that hold different hypotheses. So, for example, all of us who are involved in this, we think that the hypothesis has some merit. I mean, after all, we have 400,000 to 1 odds against chance.
Sure.
That something's happening. But there are other people who say, no, this is just random chance, and if we looked at the data, we wouldn't find that. Well, we know that if other analysts look at the data that we've already collected, they will get the same result because we've gone through that exercise. So we know it's not a mistake. But what we don't know is, for future events, if we get 6 analysts, all of whom hold the opposite hypothesis, well, what would they end up with? That's why we want this parallel network. The other thing that we're doing is rewriting the software so that we can take even and odd seconds and put them into different databases. Because the idea is that if you're dealing with an event that takes a day or half a day to unfold, then it shouldn't matter if we're looking at only the even second data or the odd second data. You should get roughly the same result. So we've done that analysis also, but also on these existing 200 events. And you do get the same result on the 200 events. But again, we want to see what's going to happen if we carry this forward. Do we continue to get this this kind of evidence?
What an exciting project. Do you find that the random generators, Dean, have more of a spike during emotional events such as 9/11 or the tsunami as opposed to exciting events, had we, let's say, been able to check in on the generators during the moon landing in 1969, for example, an event where everybody was just euphoric, would you see a difference or would it be the same?
We've begun to look at that by taking the emotional valence, it's called. It's positive or negative, the direction of the emotion for these 200 events. And you can separate them into things like natural disasters, and terrorism, and celebrations.
Okay.
And to some extent, it looks like the celebrations do better in terms of the...
Really?
Yeah, in terms of the effect on the network. And it can kind of make sense that I think that what the network is reflecting is coherent mind. It's the mind of many people, but it's become coherent, roughly in the same way that can take a light bulb, and if you made it Lay's, and turn it into a laser, it's still light, but it's coherent light. And coherent light is much more power in terms of its ability to do anything than a soft glowing light bulb. So something like that seems to occur with mind. Coherent mind is much more orderly and, in a sense, powerful, and has an effect on the environment that we can measure.
Dean, I bet the generators go wild around New Year's Eve.
We've looked at all of the New Year's Eve we have so far, and I think I talk about this in the book. Overall, it shows an effect which is kind of like what you'd expect. You start showing random behavior up until about 5 minutes before the clock strikes midnight in each time zone, and then it becomes very non-random for about 5 minutes, and then it goes back being random again.
I love it. Stay with us. We're going to talk now about his book, Entangled Minds, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, Dean Radin. Now, Dean, interesting title for the new book, Entangled Minds. Tell me how you came up with that and why.
The word entangled refers to quantum entanglement. It also, just the word itself, it suggests a mixing of minds. The entanglement portion of it is referring specifically to what we now know to be true, that at the subatomic level, when particles interact, they remain connected. And the interesting thing is that they remain connected throughout space and time. And what that means is that when we think about why psychic phenomena are interesting, they're interesting because they transcend the usual boundaries of space and time. I mean, that's really what the anomaly is.
Sure.
And if we imagine that we're living in the universe as portrayed by our senses, like a common sense universe, then these phenomena don't make any sense at all. I mean, almost literally, they don't make common sense. They're nonsense. But that has to do with our vision of what we think the fabric of reality is. So if a few hundred years ago you had told somebody that, you know, as you approach the speed of light, you're able to see that time and space are very closely related. In fact, they're transforms of each other. And if you told somebody that matter and energy was the same, they would think you're nuts. Well, now we know that matter and energy basically are the same, and time and space are deeply related. So the common sense view of the world, the fabric of reality, has really dramatically changed over the past century. But most people think that we don't need to worry about it because it's not in the world that we live in.
Right.
It's not like the everyday world. Well, for relativity, that's probably true. For quantum effects, we're beginning to see that it's not true, that quantum effects scale up into the world that we live in. And you can see in major scientific journals like Science and Nature, almost every issue now has a new development in entanglement. And the reason why it's a hot area in science now is because everybody's trying to build a quantum computer. And in order to get it to work, you have to get a better handle on how to sustain entanglement, not simply in the subatomic world, but in the world that we live in.
And you wrote that Albert Einstein once called entanglement spooky action at a distance.
Yeah. Albert Einstein didn't like the idea that particles could be connected even though you couldn't see the connection. Because he, like a lot of people, held a classical view of the way the world ought to work. But we now know that the world doesn't work that way. That's simply not how it is, down at some deep level. So a way of thinking of what this means is that we need to revise our understanding of the fabric of reality. We know that that fabric is made out of non-local threads.
Yet there's got to be a physics behind this as well, and it's ironic that Einstein didn't see that then.
Well, everybody's embedded in the world that they grow up in. I mean, Einstein did a major and radical shift in terms of our understanding of matter and energy and space and time. But he, you know, geniuses are not able to be genius about everything. We know now that these quantum effects, as strange as they were predicted by the mathematics of quantum theory, which came directly out of the study of light, trying to understand the strange nature of light. And it's no longer simply a theory, because the effects have been tested repeatedly in the laboratory, and we know that non-locality is a fact. So even though quantum theory may someday be replaced by something more sophisticated or more comprehensive, we know that the fact-like nature of non-local connections will maintain, because that's what we can measure.
I think what's really important tonight, too, as we continue chatting about this, Dean, is to tell us a little bit about you and your involvement, how you got involved in this, because I'm sure there's a remarkable story behind this. It's not every day that somebody truly understands the power of the mind. You know, my great aunt, who is now no longer with us, Shafika Karegula, one of the first in the world to really start devoting time and attention to the mind. She used to work with Ingo Swann on a lot of different things. But you've done this, and you're doing it now. What happened to you to allow you to do this?
Well, I'm afraid it's a very mundane story. I grew up in a family of artists and musicians, and my first career was going to be a concert violinist. I was a prodigy on the violin, and everyone thought, including me, that that's what I'd end up doing for my career. But somewhere in college years, I also discovered that I was good at science and math. And it seemed like an easier way to make a living with your mind than with your body, which is what musicians do. No one told me back when I was a kid that being a professional musician means that you're an athlete. Now, we don't normally think of it as that, but in fact,
but you are.
You must be. Yes, any performer of any type is an athlete. And my body has never been particularly strong, so it was easy to play well, but it wasn't particularly easy over long periods of time, which is necessary if you're going to really be a performer. So I was happy to see that I could do other things. And maybe I had a natural high level of empathy. I was always able to put myself in somebody else's shoes very easily, even as a little kid. So when I would read stories about psychic phenomena, and as kids will do, we'll read books about fairy tales and so on, all of that seemed perfectly natural to me. And then, of course, as I became a scientist, I realized that it's not natural at all compared to what we're taught in school. And I was always puzzled about this very strong resistance in the scientific world against these phenomena. I've learned a little along the way about why these prejudices come about. But the fact is that lots and lots of scientists in many different disciplines, they're all interested in these topics. When I give a talk to an academic or a scientific audience, it's always standing room only. And so I ask the audience, well, how come it's just me up here?
That's right. Why?
Yeah, why? The reason is partly there's a taboo in the academic world. You're simply not allowed to study certain topics.
Are they afraid, Dean, to put their names to papers and in research?
It is socially unacceptable. The power of the taboo is just astonishing.
That's a shame.
But sometimes I will say, look, if the taboo is broken someday and there's funding available to do this stuff, how many of you, meaning scientists and the audience, would like to spend time looking into this? And typically 60 to 70% of the audience will admit it. Well, that's amazing, because that 60 to 70% of that scientific audience is the same percentage as the general public. The 60 to 70% of the general public admit very strong interest in these phenomena. And the reason why everyone is interested is because everyone has the experiences. So sometimes people say, well, but why would you want to spend your scientific career studying something as mundane as telepathy or the feeling of being stared at from a distance?
Well, to me, that would be exciting.
Well, it is. But sometimes you have to explain to people, why is that so interesting, just besides the scientific aspects of it? And the answer is that we're dealing here with a spectrum of abilities. On the very common, frequently reported, mundane level, we're talking about things like gut feelings and telepathy and those sorts of experiences, which most people have. But somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, we're talking about apparitions, we're talking about prophecy, evidence for survival after bodily death. We call those people who do this psychics and mediums. Further up the spectrum, we're now talking about creative insight. We're talking about genius, prodigies, new creations in science and art and music. Further up the scale, we're talking about religious epiphanies. And near the top of the scale, we're talking about mystical union, which is the power underlying most religions. I claim that that is the same scale. At one end, you have gut feelings. At the other end, you have mystical insights. So at the top end of that scale, we're talking about very profound, somewhat rare events that literally change the world. These are the ideas that change society, technology, religion, the whole ball of wax.
In a big way.
Yeah. And we can't study that very well because there are very few people who have these mind-blowing events occur, and they don't happen in the laboratory. So instead, we study what we can study. In the laboratory, we can study telepathy and gut feelings and things of that sort. So the reason why I'm interested in these then is because, yes, telepathy is interesting from a scientific perspective, but ultimately because it tells us a little bit more about this full spectrum of human experience, of which one end of it creates the world as we experience it.
I was going to say, you've gone from being a musician to a scientist that studies these incredible things. And to coin a pun, were you sort of tuned into it, so to speak? I mean, have you had the ability to do some of the things that we're talking about, the intuitiveness and the ability to really touch this entanglement?
Well, I've certainly met people who are very, very talented. And a wide range of these abilities, much more talented than I am. But after working in the field for a while, I realized that talent manifests in different ways. I have a certain talent to do these studies in a scientific way.
Right.
And I generally do fairly well in my own experiments. So yes, I have some talent in this area. Interestingly, we now know through experiments that musicians and creative artists and other people whose livelihoods depend on creativity in some way generally do a lot better in these laboratory tests than people who are not particularly creative. And there's some speculation that musicians in particular, and especially stringed instrument musicians, if they start young and they practice for years as a youth, their brain becomes different. Because if you think about, especially a violin, where there's no frets on the keyboard or on the fingerboard, you have to learn to do very fine motor control movements in your left hand. You're holding the bow and doing different movements in your right hand with the bow, and you have to listen very carefully in order to get the intonation right. So your brain is being forced to do an enormous amount of work that is partially the left brain and partially the right brain. And it trains the brain to become extremely good at talking, at the two hemispheres to talk to each other. And so we're beginning to think that what used to be called right-brained awareness is more sensitive to psychic impressions. So if you have a good communication channel open between the two halves of your brain, it's as though information comes in through the right brain, and it can make an easy channel to the left, which is where language and your ability to articulate comes from.
I've always believed that people who are a little more creative have that ability. And do you find, Dean, that these people who have been practicing this over time get better and better and better at this?
I would say they get a little bit better, but the best analogy I can think of is sports talent. So if you get somebody who is very good at basketball or baseball or whatever, they will plateau fairly quickly at a very high level. And that level is much, much higher than a person who's not talented. But to get beyond that plateau is extremely difficult. So, I mean, take as an example someone like Tiger Woods, who was clearly naturally very talented, but also practices like mad all the time to maintain that high plateau. So one would think that if practice can keep making you better, then he would get better and better and better. But the fact is that we all plateau at some point.
And sometimes he has a lousy game.
And sometimes he has a lousy game, just like a real psychic. Real psychics can sometimes get the hole in one, but not always.
Premonition. Let's talk about the various aspects of this, if we can. There are some people who have had these incredible premonitions of events, call them earthquakes, 9/11. I know my daughter had a very strange dream a couple days before that. Unfortunately, nobody in the family could understand what she was talking about, nor could she. But after the fact, we all realized that there was something there. A lot of people have had these. But a lot of people, Dean, don't know what they are. They don't react to them.
Mm-hmm.
They come in, they come out, and then after the event occurs, they go, oh, my, it was that.
Right.
Why is that? Why can't they grasp onto this before it happens?
Well, I think part of the reason is that for negative events, which is what we usually respond to, we respond more to negative mm-hmm. things rather than positive things, which is why the news is the way that it is. Nobody wants to walk around with visions of nasty things in their heads, so we tend to repress it. I mean, it's a natural psychological response to I'm getting bad feelings about stuff, and I don't want bad feelings in my head, so I literally repress it, and I become no longer aware of it. That's one of the reasons why I think we don't see this. The other reason is that that people will sometimes get a negative impression about something, and then they're afraid to tell anybody, because you know who wants to be the Chicken Little and say about things that are coming up. There's no one to tell, or except maybe for a few family members, mm-hmm. and nobody knows if it's true or not. So that actually leads me to one of the projects they have in mind, which is to have an internet site which will allow people who have these experiences, whether they're awake or in dreams, to register it. And then we can tell it by looking at thousands or tens of thousands of people and analyzing the effects over time. Maybe people do not get the actual content in a dream, but it may be that before unusual events, perhaps the quality of the dream will change.
What a great idea. And that could be instant, too. They can just immediately wake up, go to the site.
Right.
We might be able to broadcast. Is this website something that's up and running now?
It's running in my head.
Ah.
It's on the drawing board, and I have a pretty good sense of what I'm going to do, but it's not active yet.
As soon as you get the domain name, Dean, let us know, and we'll get it out.
I will.
I mean, that could be exciting.
Yeah, and it's, in a sense, it's the human version of our Global Consciousness Project. It's using humans as detectors rather than random number generators. And I expect, this is the reason why I want to do this, I expect that as a detection network, it'll be much more sensitive than our random numbers.
What is this that we call our gut feeling? And, you know, that to me, it's a physical thing, but it's tied into a mental ability as well, isn't it?
Well, what it is literally visceral sensations in your gut. Some people will feel they're churning in their gut. They'll feel movement. They may feel a twinge of nausea, something of that sort. That's what gut feelings are. And typically it has no cognitive content to it. It's not a gut feeling about something. It's simply a gut feeling. So people can learn, I think, to associate the gut feelings with either fleeting thoughts that they've had, typically involving something to do with a decision. There's a decision coming up and they get a gut feeling about it. We tested this in the laboratory to see whether it might have a psychic component to it, and I devote a small chapter in the book to the results of the experiment, the bottom line of which was the gut does seem to respond to distant thoughts.
Does that tell you that it's something within the human body that kicks in beyond the mind, or is it merely just something that the brain creates?
There are those who now believe that the brain is not the only source of perception in the body, that the heart may be a perceptive organ as well as the body, and the gut too. I mean, the gut is particularly interesting because it has next to the brain not only the same kind of neurons as the brain has, but it has the second highest density of those neurons anywhere in the body. So the gut is sometimes called the second brain because it has all of the capacity to do what we do up in our head, except it's in the gut.
Stay with us, Dean. We'll be back in a moment as we talk more about this incredible story, Entangled Minds, Extrasensory Experiences in a Quantum Reality. I'm George Norrie. I'm talking to one of the best, Dean Radin, on Coast to Coast AM. Dean, in your work, are you a believer that all of us collectively have the ability to alter events? You know, we're beginning to show that these random generators are depicting that, you know, we're feeling things. But what about our ability to change the course of an event? Is that possible?
I think it is. When I'm responding to questions about belief, I almost always have to add in immediately that I base my belief on the data. And the data says to me that if individuals can push randomness around, and it appears that collectively we can also push it around, and I don't see any reason that we couldn't pull ourselves into the future that we wish to go towards.
Is there a particular time of the day where people are stronger with this power, whatever it may be, this mind power, this ability to do what they do, daytime, nighttime, does this matter?
Well, there is a possibility that the local sidereal time is a modulator of this ability. But local sidereal time is not clock time. It's the time as told by the stars. So is there a time of day? I don't think so. I mean, it's interesting that this program goes through the hour, 3 o'clock in the morning,
mm-hmm.
in which the highest density of reports occur, spontaneous psychic reports.
3 o'clock in the morning?
Typically around 3 o'clock in the morning, yeah. So it's not entirely clear why that is. It may have something to do with different hormones that are active at that time of the day. But we don't really know.
What do you think of the possibilities of conducting an experiment one day when you're ready, using this incredible mass? You know, and Art used to do this, and he has now shied away from it, does not want anything to do with mass consciousness or experiments.
Mm-hmm.
I've dabbled in it, some of it very successful, some of it out of control. I'm not willing to toss it away. I think that under the right harness, it could be very powerful and could work real well for us. But would you ever want to conduct one day, Dean, in some kind of experiment where you know the generators will be monitored for a specific thing and we just ask this vast audience to do something? I mean, would that work? Would that give us good data?
Well, it might, but generally we don't know enough. There's two things here. One is we don't know enough on any particular episode about whether it's going to work. We know probabilistically how it'll work, but we don't know that it will work on that particular occasion, just like Tiger Woods doesn't know that he's going to get a hole-in-one
sure.
at any given time. So there are many unknowns here. And because there are unknowns, we're always going to be butting heads with the law of unintended consequences. You know, if some place is in a drought, and collectively we can make it rain there, well, we're, you know, the Earth is a zero-sum game. We've had to pull the moisture from somewhere else. Did that mean that solving the drought here creates a drought somewhere else? So since we don't really know enough yet about these very complicated systems at the size of the world, I can imagine an experiment that might be more constrained. And that might be something that... there will be an opportunity perhaps in the next year or so
right.
to try something exactly like that.
Is it dangerous for a novice, someone like me, to go before a vast audience and say, hey, let's do this. Let's move this hurricane. We've done this before. Let's do, you know, let's concentrate on finding Osama bin Laden. Let's concentrate on this or that. Is that dangerous? Does it have consequences?
Well, it certainly has consequences. My guess is that there's a lot of inertia in the world. The world is a big place. It doesn't like to get pushed around very much. And sometimes the more you shove, the more it shoves back. So it is potentially dangerous, primarily because of the unknowns. But I think the danger is actually fairly small. So if you felt that it was interesting to experiment, I would say go ahead.
Absolutely. So many people, when they are just feeling good about something, Dean, they will say, you know, I'm in the groove. I can't miss. No matter what I do, it's working for me. And we've all done that. It's a great feeling. Sometimes we don't stay in the groove, unfortunately. What is that? What is that about the human mind, the psyche, that allows us to do that, where everything seems to work? Is it our mind that's doing it? What's happening here? Is it beyond chance?
It's a very interesting question. It's sometimes called flow. Or a felt sense, a kind of a phase shift that occurs. Before we started the Global Consciousness Project, we were doing experiments in groups where groups would go through these kinds of phase shifts. And since I played in orchestras for many years, and this is true for choral groups, any kind of team play, that sometimes the team just becomes extremely tight and coherent. And not only can the team tell the difference, but if there's an audience, they can tell the difference as well. And those are the events in which we see changes in randomness. The randomness goes away. So what's interesting is that this felt sense of some kind of amazing order, that everybody's in the flow or in the zone, that is reflected by a change in the environment. So my guess is that what's happening is, as I said before, that minds become coherent. And coherence carries a certain kind of power that we can detect in the environment.
I used to ask my mother, Dean, who's pretty intuitive in her own way, you know, I just say, Mom, when I was a young kid, you know, who are we? Why are we? And beyond some of the spiritual answers she would give me, we really didn't have an answer to that. A question and a series of questions that continue to baffle me and I'm sure millions of other people every day. In this particular case, when you talk about, you know, the entanglement of the minds, this sort of a web that's out there, have you come to a point yet where you can really say to yourself, I know what this is. I know how it works. It's part of the universe, always was, and this is what it does?
No. I don't think I'm smart enough to know that with any confidence. But I have developed a theory, which is actually not a new theory. It's been around quite a while. But the new element of it is that we're beginning to see how it makes physical sense. There's like a new rationality that we can bring to bear on what used to be considered pure mysticism. And it comes about because of quantum entanglement. That's why I wrote the book about this in some detail to explain how and what it means. And actually, the question you asked about who am I? What is the self? When you talk about I, who are you talking about? What is that thing that's able to ask that question? What a phenomenon like telepathy suggests, or entangled minds in a broader sense, is it's not always so clear that who the self is.
No, you're right, because I mean there are days I'll sit down and I'll be, you know, your mind of course determines a lot, your personality and your thinking process. But you know, you look at yourself and you go, you know, I'm in this body, I'm in this mass of stuff. But is this really me? You know, it's just a shell. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can't answer the question. And sometimes it gets to be so frustrating, I've got to walk away from it or I'll go nuts.
Right. Yeah. Part of it is that our language is not equipped to talk about the form of coherence and holism that I think is necessary to really get an understanding of this.
I mean, you sit across the table, let's say, at a nice restaurant with friends, people you really care about, and you're all talking, and you look at each other in the same thing. Who are they? I mean, it's just what makes up their makeup? And then, of course, when you join the hereafter, then things really start to get interesting.
Right.
Because I think, and I think you're absolutely right, and in the book itself is fascinating. I think that whatever is out there has been there since the beginning of time and has every place in the universe as any physical thing that we can see. And I also think that maybe it started first.
Right. I think that is an increasing likelihood. If you just think about the theories that people have proposed, if matter and energy and space and time are now seen as unities, I think that at some point we're going to find that mind is actually sitting underneath them, in which case the universe, in a sense, is like a giant mind. Our sense of it is as though, you know, if you have a hologram and you break the hologram, that each piece of the hologram will show the whole picture, but it doesn't show it in quite as great detail. It's a diminished picture, but it's the whole thing, because that's the nature of a hologram. It is as though our sense of self and I is a tiny piece, tiny little piece of a hologram, which is actually of the entire universe.
Is this leading us, Dean, to finding that that divine creator, that special one thing that maybe jump-started all of this?
That may be the full hologram, of which we are a piece.
I like that.
Yeah. Now, it raises an interesting question as well, and you sometimes have people talking about near-death experiences or sightings of apparitions. When people report these things, they oftentimes will have a significant change in their personality. Sometimes it happens in a snap, and they become a different person. So this is one of the projects that we've been interested in at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And we're working in collaboration with two other universities to study the conditions under which people change and why they change and how long it lasts and all the rest of it. What our initial research shows that 39% of adults in the United States report having had a spiritual or a religious experience that changed their lives, more or less permanently. So we've created a survey to help understand, to help learn what it is that causes these things. And for people who'd like to try it, they can go to a website which has this survey in it, and which you'll probably learn more about yourself than you thought you knew.
What's the site?
It's www.transformationsurvey.com. It takes between 30 minutes and an hour or so to complete. But we hope to get several thousand people to fill it out and help us learn a little bit more about how is it that people can change almost in a snap.
Now, what do you do with the data, Dean, once it's all done? I mean, how do you present it? Do you put it in a special paper? Can you get it published? Who takes it?
Well, it will definitely be published. It may eventually turn into a book because it's part of a longer-term project that we're looking at. It started initially by taking 50 leaders of transformational practices, everything from yoga to you name it, all kinds of different practices, and these are the teachers. And we did extensive video interviews and analysis of what they said, you know, of all these different traditions to find out what's common among the teachings of different kinds of transformation and what differs. And it turns out that there are a number of things that seem to be common among the teachers of transformation, and now we want to go to individuals who've actually had these experiences spontaneously to see whether or not what we think we found will hold up in real experience.
And when you talk about common, what are some of those aspects?
Well, usually the among the changes that can occur are things like a change in perception. People may have the same kinds of experiences that they had before, but their perception of the experience will be different. So somebody, for example, who might be driving in traffic and become angry if somebody cuts them off.
Yeah.
After the transformation, they will notice the event. They may notice that they momentarily become angry, but it immediately goes away. Because instead of feeling anger, they might feel compassion for the person who is in such a rush that they feel they had to cut them off.
When I was a kid growing up in Detroit, we lived in what I thought was a big house. And years later, Dean, I mean years later, I went by and saw that little house again. And I'm talking about small.
Mm-hmm.
It must have been two bedrooms. It was made out of wood. It was on the north side of Detroit by Joy Road, for those of us in Detroit listening right now. And I'm telling you, it couldn't have been any smaller. But yet, when I was a kid, my perception of this house was that it was huge.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, when I went back to see it, it was so small, I couldn't believe that a family of, at that time, four, my sister, we went off, I have two sisters, but at that time, just the one, I couldn't believe that we would live there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a perception change. And is it this way? Does it work that way where you what one perceives changes maybe later on?
It's generally the same idea. Of course, when you go back to a childhood home, your memory of it is from the perspective of someone who's 2 feet high.
True, yep.
So there is one change. The thing that is different here is that generally these transformations occur as adults. Sometimes as younger adults, but nevertheless, it happens typically fairly fast, and it can be amazing that one day you're an angry person, and the next day you're a loving person. Well, how did that happen?
Exactly. I mean, and how come some days people... Now, this is what I find to be strange, too. Some days you could wake up and feel that blah feeling. You just don't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not so sure it's physical because you're functioning, your arms are working well, your legs are working well. I mean, your body's okay, but you have in your head just this feeling of blah or melancholy, whatever you want to call it. And then you're right. The next day, you might be, you know, as high as a kite with life. What
right.
causes that?
Well, where do the thoughts in your head come from? We normally think of the thoughts in my head belong to me. They're isolated from the rest of the world. But all of this research about entangled mind suggests that maybe a lot of it's in your head, maybe a lot of it is actually being produced by the brain, but not all of it.
Is it a chemical imbalance or what?
Well, you may be picking up things that are going on in from people who are around you or loved ones at a distance. In other words, your feelings, your perceptions about yourself, all the rest of it is partially in you and it's partially outside of you. So if you get a feel, if you wake up someday and you just feel incredibly anxious and you don't know why, maybe you're picking up the anxiety of somebody else. Maybe you're picking up a premonition of something else. Now, it's important not to go overboard on this because you can start seeing signs and things, you know, out there. You become paranoid very quickly.
True.
But nevertheless, all of this research suggests that our ordinary sense of self is not limited to just yourself.
Is it also why then some people want to surround themselves with people of high energy, very positive, as opposed to what I call these energy zappers, these psychic vampires, Dean, that suck the energy from you?
Absolutely. Yeah, if you have the choice, you'd have to be a masochist to want to hang around people who are sucking your energy. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I've heard the term psychic vampire before, and I'm not sure whether I agree with that or not, but I certainly have known people who are just very draining to be around.
They can empty a room, Dean.
Yeah.
I've seen it happen. I've talked about this example of someone in St. Louis who went into a lounge, and the place had 100 people in there. Within 15 minutes, everyone had left except for that person and the poor bartender who was stuck there. And, I mean, and he told me an incredible story the next day that he had this feeling of just he didn't feel well. He said he was fine, but this guy walks in and he feels awful. Now, the individual in question is actually a nice person, wouldn't hurt a fly. But for some reason, he's got an ability to just grab your energy, and I'm not even sure he knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. Those cases do exist. As the scientist in me is immediately thinking that this is something that we definitely should study.
Absolutely.
Something to do with a bioelectromagnetic change or pheromone change, something of that sort. But since we have to select things that we study, I think I'll choose something else for now.
Hey, Dean, let's get into telepathy, clairvoyance when we come back, psychokinesis. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Mr. Radin, give us your definition of telepathy, if you will.
Telepathy, the exchange of emotions, typically emotions, sometimes sense of information from one person to the other. That is not mediated through the ordinary senses.
Are they doing it on purpose, or does it just happen at random?
Well, in the laboratory, it's done on purpose, but I strongly suspect that it can happen unconsciously as well.
Now, does that include, let's say, and you cite the example in the book, Entangled Minds, and we've all done this. I don't know why. Maybe you can explain it, where the phone rings, and you know who it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know who it is. You pick it up, and there they are.
Right.
What causes that?
Before I give you an answer, I'll give a little event that happened with my wife and I.
Okay.
We oftentimes will read our email on each of us having a separate computer, in the living room while watching television. Because, as you know, you get so much email all the time, if you don't keep up with it, then you get overwhelmed.
Oh, I know. You're boggled down for sure.
Right. So we're sitting in a place where neither of us can see the other person's screen, and I'm reading an email from a colleague who's talking about a book that he's writing on deja vu. And it's a revision of a previous book that he wrote, so he's calling it Deja Vu Revisited. And I thought that was a clever title. And the moment that I thought that, my wife suddenly says, I'm getting the strangest feeling of deja vu. So this is a very nice synchronicity because
Sure. It's
a synchronicity about synchronicities, essentially. It's a deja vu about deja vus. And I just like the recursive nature of the event.
Now, was she picking that up, do you think, from you? Or maybe something from the computer electronically in her brain? What was causing that?
Well, I think it's very unlikely that she was picking up something from the computer in an electronic sense, but she may have picked it up clairvoyantly. my guess is that she was picking it up from me, because I had this internal sense of delight at the title of the book. But the fact that she experienced déjà vu, it wasn't that she had the idea of déjà vu, she actually experienced one. So this is this shows something about the complexity in which people can have telepathic connections that don't necessarily involve a feeling of emotion or a particular thought.
What about the ability to really understand someone? So here you are, this is your wife, you've been together for a long time, you know each other, you understand each other. Would you two have a better chance of having this kind of telepathy event as opposed to two complete strangers?
I think so. And so here's my model of how I think what's going on.
All right.
Ultimately, I think that mind extends throughout the universe. It extends in such a way that it is not tightly bound by space or time. But now we're talking about all minds. Everyone's individual mind is actually part of this gigantic, interconnected, mind-like stuff. That is what I think we're seeing when we look at quantum entanglement. We're looking at a form of connectivity, but it's a much more complicated form when we're talking about it in terms of awareness. So the reason why my wife picks up on what I'm thinking or what I'm experiencing is because if you imagine a mind the size of the universe, although it's localized in you, well, what are you going to pay attention to? Each individual is probably scanning, to use a word, scanning perhaps 10 things of interest in their lives. It's going to be loved ones, regardless of where they happen to be.
True.
And it may be something like events that will affect them today or tomorrow.
True. Not a day goes by. I have three children, all in St. Louis, Dean. Not a day goes by, especially when I'm in L.A., where I don't think about them. What are they doing? And, you know, I'll send them a little text message, an email, try to make a phone call to them. But you're right.
Okay. And that's at the conscious level. So if you're aware consciously of thinking of your children, then unconsciously you're always thinking of them. So now imagine that your attention actually extends throughout the universe as well, but you've just created a couple of filters. There's a filter on each child. It's always there. It's always being concerned about what is the state of this child. If something happened to a child, whether it's positive or negative, it doesn't matter, that will tend to come to your awareness more likely than what's happening on Pluto. Even though if you tuned your attention towards Pluto, you could probably detect that as well.
You might. Now, does this, okay, you may have already answered this then with that statement, but does whatever it is in this universe that allows this to happen, will it always occur in a very natural state, or do you really as an individual have to be tuned in to do this? Do you have to practice, or is it just always there for you?
It is always there because that's the fabric of reality. That's the stuff we are made out of. It's not like your mind has to go out and find something or make the connection. Rethink this as the actual medium in which we live. That's the connectivity that's there all the time.
Is it like a radio in that the signal, you know, where we are, we broadcast to nearly 500 radio stations. Our signal is out, whether somebody's radio is on or not. It's out there, but the minute that radio's turned on, they get us. Is it almost the same way as that?
So, yeah, some people think of consciousness. What is consciousness? Some people think it is literally the construction of the brain. It's brain stuff. Other people say, no, the brain is actually a receiver of consciousness. The brain, it becomes like a radio. So, I mean, imagine that you're a caveman and you're looking at a working radio. And of course, you would think that the voices coming out of the radio, there must be people inside the radio.
You would think little people.
Right. And so you could take it apart, and you're looking for the people, and you can't find any, and you're puzzled. So in modern neuroscience, we take apart the brain, and we're puzzled because we can't find where consciousness is. And this is what gives rise to this notion of the brain as a receiver of consciousness.
Yet there's got to be a real science behind this somewhere.
Well, I think what we're beginning to see with quantum physics is a description of this fabric of reality that we live in. And as I said before, that it is as though the fabric of reality is made up out of these non-local threads. that we can see in the laboratory now. But we're much more than simply a fabric. It's as though the fabric can be used to create a quilt. It's a higher complexity structure, but it's still made up out of non-local threads. And the quilt then is made into a tapestry, and the tapestry is made into something else, and so on. And what you're doing by using this metaphor is you're going from the subatomic world into atoms, into molecules, into biology, chemistry, and so on, all the way up the line until you end up at the human, at human experience. But that human experience is still built up out of the same stuff that we see in fundamental physics. And what we see down there is something that is extremely different than what your ordinary senses tell you about the world. At that level, there's nothing that's separate. There's no isolation, and everything is connected.
Do you believe, Dean, that successful people have this ability, they use it, and they use it quite regularly in their day-to-day routine?
I believe that that is one of the reasons that they are successful. And it spans every realm of human endeavor. I've met venture capitalists who will privately tell me of all their wonderful psychic experiences. The reason they're successful is because they trust their intuition and it works. And I've met people who are in sports who use it to their advantage, doctors, virtually every realm you can think of. People who tend to be very successful and confident in their success are using at some level this form of awareness. Because if you think about it, if your mind actually extends through space and time and the universe, you could find out anything you wish.
Absolutely. And though in terms of success, a barometer shouldn't be financial success, but it makes it easier to judge. Do you ever, or have you ever stumbled across anybody who is so-called successful and who didn't have this ability?
Yeah, I've met a few people who are successful, but in general it was either an accident, because there still are some accidents, or they were like being born into a rich family. You know, if you're born into a family that is rich enough, it's very difficult to lose everything unless you're completely stupid. So somebody could be, in an outward sense, be very wealthy and own a bunch of businesses and all the rest of it, and actually not be interested in the psychic world at all. But what's interesting is the fact that they're not interested doesn't mean it doesn't exist for them. It still exists, because we're dealing with we're with physics here, not with something like mind power. You know, it's the medium in which we live. It's not something that we create. So their attention may not be tuned in the same way that a psychic's attention may be tuned, but nevertheless, they still have access to the information whether they're aware of it or not.
Have you become a believer in other universes? Perhaps there's other Dean Radins and George Norris out there?
That I'm not so sure about. I'm having enough challenge trying to understand this universe, and extending it out into other universes just makes the problem more complicated.
Let's get back to the why again, Dean. I would agree with you that it's there. There's no doubt about it, and it's been there. It's been there for at least 13-plus billion years that this universe has existed, mm-hmm. and it's very possible it was there before this universe existed.
Mm-hmm.
But why and how? How did it get there?
Well, why is not a question that science can answer.
And may never answer.
No, it's you know, it's like saying, well, why do we have psychic experiences? My answer to that is that that's because this is the nature of the medium in which we live. I mean, it's starting to sound like a broken record, but if you live in a certain kind of environment, then you will experience certain things. I mean, if you're a fish and you're living in water that has a certain current in it, and you find yourself caught in the current, you're going to get pulled by it. And so the fish could say, well, why am I being pulled by this? And the answer is because that's the nature of the medium. So that's my answer here. But why is there water? Why is there air? Why are those why questions we don't really know? If maybe a really good psychic, if posed with that question and able to tune their attention to the universe at large, maybe they'll be able to download an answer that would make sense. My own preference is to say that it's the same answer as why is there light? You know, it simply is.
And, you know, maybe we are not destined to get the answer. Maybe we just have to use this to the best of our abilities?
My guess is that our brains are not complex enough to be able to understand the answer, even if it was given to us. I mean, there are plenty of mystics throughout the years who have tried to translate their experience of the answer, but they can never quite do it. They try to create metaphors of an explanation and will use words like God to explain it, but that's not really an explanation. It's a story that is made up that is as close to what their experience is like. And that's why I have the sense that we're not equipped yet in their current human form to be able to understand these kinds of things.
Have you ever dabbled in the dream state with some of these abilities?
I occasionally will have interesting dreams, and there is a whole class of experiments looking at telepathy and clairvoyance in the dream state. And there's very good evidence that people are sensitive in the dream state to these effects, even in the laboratory.
Maybe even more so than when they're awake.
Not necessarily more so, I don't think. I think that evolution has pushed us in such a way as to make the ordinary waking state, more or less the way that we are right now, the waking state, to be the worst possible state to be psychic in. And the reason is that when you're awake and the brain is awake and paying attention to the here and now, you're by definition no longer paying attention to the there and then. You know, we have a limited amount of attention that we can allocate. And if your ordinary senses are running full steam, you're forced to pay attention to things that are close to you. In the dream state, or if you're meditating, or in some other non-ordinary state, we can allocate our attention differently. And that's, I think, why psychic experiences are much, much stronger and, in a sense, more controllable when you're not in an ordinary state.
Have you had the ability to do telepathy on a regular basis beyond the story that you just mentioned with your wife?
In a controlled sense, no. Occasionally something interesting will occur, but it's almost always spontaneous. So in that sense, I'm not so talented in being able to control it. And I kind of suspect that I specifically keep it at arm's length.
I was going to say, do you have some kind of block there or something?
Yeah, I think I could make it more evident than I do. But I think there's some value in maintaining a certain stability in one's life.
Do you think you do that because you research this field and you feel as if, you know, you don't want to get that close to it?
It's partially that, but it's also because I've learned over the years that when people contact me about their interest in this, the overwhelming majority of people want it to stop. They want to learn how to turn it off.
Why?
Because they feel like they're almost literally losing their mind. They no longer have control over their own thoughts and their own functioning because they become buffeted by other people's emotions and other people's thoughts and stories. And so it will cause your everyday ability to function to significantly decline. And so this is one of the reasons why I don't teach people how to become psychic, because I think it actually is, it's not a very good idea to teach someone how to be open, how to open up to the rest of the universe, unless you also teach them in at least as much detail how to close back down.
Well, that's true. Have you ever come across anyone, Dean, who by far has probably had these abilities more than anyone that you've ever come across?
I would say the person with whom I'm most familiar is Joe McMonagle, the remote viewer.
Right, and one of the best.
Right, and the reason why I think he is as good as people say he is because he's been tested in hundreds and hundreds of experiments, and so we know over a very long period of time that sometimes he is as spectacular as it gets. You know, it's the hole in one, and it happens often enough under controlled conditions that we know that he's very good.
Is he still doing what he's doing?
He is, yes. I expect that there are other people like Joe that are out there. In fact, that just from a statistical point of view, we know that there are people out there that are as good as Joe. But he's one who has been involved in laboratory work for a long time, so we have high confidence about him.
He's been tested.
Right.
Where do you get the book, Entangled Minds?
Well, I have two choices here. If you want to get it, if you just can't wait to get it, then go to entangledminds.com, and you'll end up buying it through Amazon, ultimately.
Okay.
If you are willing to wait a couple weeks, you should go to www.ions.org, I-O-N-S.org, which is the site for the Institute of Noetic Sciences. And if you click on the top of the page there, you'll be brought to a place where you can get the book for $1.
$1?
Yes. It's part of a special promotion that IONS is doing to get people interested in IONS and so on. And it essentially becomes a premium. It's a
that
premium
may be worth
$1.
That may be worth waiting for, Dean.
Right.
$1? So that's IONS, IONS.org?
That's right.
$1?
$1.
Entangled Minds. It retails for $14 U.S., $19 Canadian. $1. We'll be back. We'll take your phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Dean, the random generators, is that really the only so-called scientific way you're able to measure some of these events, or is there anything else out there?
Are you talking about large-scale mental events?
Not necessarily just that, but an ability to track something in some kind of scientific way.
No, we also do experiments looking at using human physiology as a detector. We're talking about things like heart rate and skin conductance and so on. Small, unconscious changes in physiology that also actually is much better in terms of how sensitive those factors are. So we thought at times to create what we call a bio-reg, a reg meaning a random event generator. So rather than having it as an electronic circuit, we create a biological version of it, a bio-reg, and actually use physiology as a detector of these things.
Could it be used as a lie detector?
Well, in essence, the equipment that is used is the same equipment that a lie detector is based on, because the tiniest change in emotion or arousal levels in the body can be easily detected by this equipment. And it kind of makes sense that people are very sensitive to other people, and as we see, even separated at a distance. So when we do experiments, for example, between couples, we'll take a bonded, emotionally bonded couple, or identical twins sometimes, or family members, separate them into two very isolated places, flash a light in it for one person, which will produce a brain event, and then look in the other person's brain, the one who's not seeing the light flash, to see if their brain responds at the same time.
Does it?
It does, yes. And what's interesting, I talk about this in the book in more detail, but this kind of experiment has been going on for a couple of decades using electroencephalograms, looking at electrical activity in the brain. But within the past 5 years, the new technology of brain scanning, the functional magnetic resonance imaging, which allows you to look in the brain to find out where the effects are actually occurring. Because with an EEG, you just have a surface measure on the brain. You have to kind of guess where in the brain the patterns are coming from. The functional MRI machine allows you to scan inside the brain. So these same experiments have been done, these separated brains experiment. And we now know that if you flash a light in one person's brain lights up in a certain way, and if you look at their partner who's at a distance and isolated, we now know where in the brain their brain is responding.
All right, let's go to the phones. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Dean Radin on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dorinda, and I'm trucking through Missouri.
Well, welcome to the program, Dorinda, and go ahead with your question.
Ever since I've been little, I get premonitions of family members who are going to die. That's why I never went to funerals, because I could always see who was going to be the next one. And I also get gut feelings on things that's going to happen to either the family member or a friend. And I'm just wondering if I should try to develop it more or just put my tail between my legs and go hide in a corner.
I wouldn't say you should go hide from it. It sounds like it's something that's useful in your life as as it is. What's interesting, though, is your experience is similar to many other people's experiences, where we become aware generally of negative things. You know, if a family member suddenly has a pleasant thing happen, for some reason we don't tend to pick those things up. So if there was any form of training that you might be interested in, it would be to pick up not just the negative parts, but the positive parts too.
What is it about the body? What is it about the mind that picks up on the negative first?
I think it's probably related to things that affect our security in our life. So our loved ones affect our lives in the same way. And we've evolved to be much more sensitive to things which are threats than the things which are not threats.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. It's your turn. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yes, this is Nathan from San Diego.
Sure, Nathan. Thank you.
I'd like to tell you about an experience I had with ESP.
Sure.
I'd like to get your take on it.
All right, fire away.
Okay, about a month ago, I was at a funeral for my grandfather. Now, I really wasn't that close to him, not as much as many of the other people at this funeral. And while I was there, I swear I was just picking up on all the emotions of everybody else around me, as you might expect for a funeral. All their negative emotions. I felt like it was driving me to the breaking point almost. I was trying to keep my composure, but it was pretty difficult. And I just felt like all the emotions I felt weren't really mine. And at that point, I looked at the man sitting in front of me, facing me. And so I concentrated on pushing all that negative emotion toward him, which I know may have not been a good thing. But as soon as I did that, within a few seconds, he started crying. And after that, I swear I just felt a major release from all the negative emotion that I had been feeling. And I wanted to get your take on that.
Well, my reaction is that intentions can be powerful things, especially when you have high motivation to focus it. I mean, you had a strong need to get those feelings out of you, and it sounds as though you were able to focus in such a way as to actually push them out. And this is one of the unintended consequences of these kinds of phenomena.
Yes, I kind of felt bad after I did that, because I've always had a strong connection with the psychic phenomena. I consider myself to have a little bit of ESP and highly intuitive.
Mm-hmm.
And I just really need to get those emotions out of me, y'all.
Well, you can use this as a lesson to see what the effect is then. There are a number of techniques that people teach to help avoid picking up emotions from other people. Whether they work or not probably depends on whether you believe they will work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Okay, appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, hi, please.
Hi, my name is Shirley.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I have a comment, and I did want to mention to you, Dr. Radin, that I do have your book, your first book, Consciousness, and I am starting to read it. I'm anxious to get your next book also. You're really appealing to my science nature here, but I wanted to make a very important, I think, comment to make regarding the spirituality of our job to do in life, is to find maybe if everything has been created by God. God is consciousness, and we are all part of that consciousness. Then we are also God, too. It's just that we don't realize it. And what I have learned from a holy man in India, which makes a lot of sense to me, and there's two books that have been written by a devotee of his. One was called Advaita Rayasa, which means space is the mind of God. And that if God is consciousness and everything is all mind, where does physical matter come from? To me, it's God. I mean, it's God's vision. He's creating everything in his mind. And there's so many marvelous things that happen to people, like when people are stuck on the road and they don't have anybody around them for miles and miles, and all of a sudden somebody comes up with a can of gas and gives them gas. And this is God working. And what I have learned, and I really accept this as being the God-awful truth, is that God created us in his mind to keep himself, you might say he keeps himself busy, but he created us so that we can learn to love him, and he loves us in the process. So it's him loving himself by himself through us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really nice. It's done great wonders for me in embracing that idea.
One of the things you asked was, where does the physical matter come from? And one way that I think of it is that it's all basically one substance. It's all consciousness or mind out there. But it goes through different phases. And so the analogy I think of is steam, water, and ice are all the same substance, but they're different phases of the same thing and in increasing density. So what we think of as physical matter may be simply a more dense form of mind.
Has there been a long-term history of psychic research, Dean, or is this relatively new?
It goes back to the origins of the beginning of science, actually, in the 1500s. And even before, I have a chapter in history where I look at 2,000-3,000 B.C., for evidence of people not only being interested in these effects, but trying to test them. So a case can be made that thousands of years before modern science, people began to experiment on these things for the same reasons that we're interested in them today. We
True.
Want to know how do I even begin to understand these things?
Mankind has been looking for the answers.
Yep.
And still hasn't found them all.
Well, I think we're doing a lot better than we used to. I mean, science is really quite new. It's only a few hundred years old as compared to how old is the human being
True.
In this form.
I mean, do you see one day, you know, a Nobel Prize in science being awarded to someone who does this kind of research?
Yes. Yeah, I think I do. It probably won't be called psychic research then. It probably won't be called parapsychology.
They'll hide it under some other umbrella.
There'll be a new name. There'll be a psychophysics or something like that.
Yeah.
Some new name.
Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air with us. Hello.
Hello, George and Dean. This is John from Lima, Ohio.
Sure, John. Go ahead.
And I was wondering if either one of you have heard of a man named Sidney Reilly. He was a British double agent. Back in the early 19th century?
Nope, I have not.
I haven't either.
Yeah, he attempted to stop the Russian Revolution by trying to have Lenin assassinated. And his wife, over in England, experienced some of the interrogations that Reilly experienced under the Russians through, like a pain communication.
Hmm.
And I was wondering if you'd ever heard of that.
I haven't heard of that, no.
Yeah, it's some of the same wounds and almost like a stigmata-type situation.
Mm-hmm. The Russians, for many years, have been studying the effect of telepathy on other people's bodies.
Weren't they way ahead of us for some time, Dean? Maybe they still are.
I think they were probably ahead of us in some areas, but we were ahead in other areas. It's like any good race. There's always somebody ahead, but then somebody else catches up.
Yeah. First time caller line, your turn. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, I'm Joe from Sioux Falls.
Welcome, Joe.
I got an experience that I just want to share, and hopefully it's related to the topic.
All right, we'll find out.
I was in my mid-teens, and my mother gave me this pane of glass that's kind of hard, like windshield-type glass. And I would use it on my bed as like a table. Play cards on it, sometimes eat, do my homework, whatever.
Okay.
And I was into EFT back then, and I put this pane of glass on the end of my bed, leaning up against the footboard, and I was thinking, I wonder if I could break this glass. And I really wanted it to break, and I was just sitting there thinking, wonder what would happen if this thing just broke. And I know I emailed you about this once, and it just shattered. It didn't fall apart. It just shattered into tiny pieces about 4 millimeters wide, square. And it just scared the heck out of me. I don't know how it happened or why it happened. And when I tried to pick it up, then it fell apart. And almost like on cue, my dog came from downstairs, upstairs, and started eating the pieces.
Oh, my gosh. What happened to the dog?
I don't know. It was like he thought it was ice or something.
I mean, but he's okay?
Yeah.
Or at least was?
He lived. I don't know how much he ate of it, but...
Hopefully not a lot. Could have been some of that safety glass. Maybe it all just powdered after.
Now, would there be a scientific explanation for this, or did this just... My mother accused me of dropping it, but yet each piece was just a square cube. It wasn't like, you know, several different sized pieces.
No, that first of all is safety glass. I mean, there's no doubt about that. The big question is why and how did it break?
Right.
Exactly.
Did he will it to break, Dean?
I think that it can happen. Certainly, though, the world is filled with all kinds of strange things like this. We know a lot more about metal than we do about glass in terms of macroscopic effects like this.
Can people actually use their brains to move objects or, in this case, shatter glass?
I think the answer is yes, except it's not their brain that's doing it. It's mind. And I tend to think of mind and brain as...
Two different things.
Certainly related, but not exactly the same.
But I guess the Chinese call it qi.
Yeah.
Some kind of energy force. I mean, they have practiced. I've seen Chinese masters, at least on videotape, you know, repel someone who's attacking them just with his energy force. They never even had to touch the individual.
Right. There are some martial arts where that becomes the martial art. It's like a mental martial art. And interestingly, a couple of years ago, I was in Japan, and there was a group that was testing to see whether or not this type of martial art was real, even when the master and the student could not see each other. So first they did it when they could see each other, and then, of course, there's a big effect, but you can explain that as the placebo effect. So then they used a screen, and the student still was repelled when the master stopped them. And then they went to either ends of a building on different floors, four floors apart, and had video on both of them at the same time, and they did their thing, and it still worked. So there is good evidence that, in this case, I don't think it was that the master was expelling force. It was more likely that they were, I think, mentally interacting with the student and causing the student to feel it mentally, and then they simply stopped in their own accord.
Yet they had the knowledge to harness this.
Yes.
And that, to me, is fascinating. I don't know why we don't teach soldiers this. We might not even need weapons.
What makes you think we don't teach soldiers this?
Good point, Dean. Of course, do you know something?
I just know that soldiers at the top of their game, who especially ones who go behind enemy lines, they learn all sorts of things. They learn anything that works.
Yeah, you may be right. They may be teaching them this. Maybe they've been doing it for a long time.
Well, I'll give you one example. Sometimes when I give a talk, I'll talk about our experiments on the feeling of being stared at. And when we do it under extremely controlled conditions where you're using closed-circuit TV and all the rest.
Yeah.
But I've spoken to snipers who explain that part of their training is that if you're a sniper and your job basically is to shoot somebody mm-hmm. far away, they know that they're also very likely to be in the crosshairs of another sniper.
Right, looking at them.
Right. So they train their intention and attention to be very careful to not put the crosshairs on the person until the very last second, because they know that the other person may be sensitive to it and move.
That's fascinating. Stay with us. Dean Radin will take final phone calls. What a fast night. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you with our guest, Dean Radin. Dean, once again, tell us about this book deal. Where can we get it?
The book deal is $1. And actually, you get more than just the book. You get other goodies with that. you'd go to www.ions.org, that's I-O-N-S.org, and you put in your email, and in about a week and a half or so, you'll get the special offer to get a CD, an audio CD, and a book, and a bunch of other stuff.
$1. I'm still in shock over that.
Right. And if you can't wait, if you just can't wait the 1 week, then go to entangledminds.com, and you can get it from Amazon right away.
Very good. Let's go back to the calls. Wildcard line, you're on the air with us. Hi there. Okay. Hello? Hello?
Hello, George?
Yeah, go ahead.
Good morning. This is Bill calling from Ralston, Nebraska, KFAB 1110.
Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I have a telepathy story to tell, and this can't be a coincidence. About 25 years ago, I was dating a lady that I worked with on the night shift, and I was spending some quality time with her son, so he and I were coming a pretty good relationship with him. One night, we got off at 7 in the morning, each went to our own apartments, and we were going to meet at her house for dinner that night. During the day, I had a dream that I had brought her son a Mr. Potato Head game. You may remember that, George.
Oh, I
sure
do.
It was popular in, what, 58, 59,
yes.
60, advertised quite a bit.
Absolutely.
I don't believe in 1982, 83, when this occurred, that was a toy that still existed or was advertised at all. Anyhow, I had a dream that I brought him this game. So later that evening, I go down, we have dinner, the three of us. He takes off to ride his bike or play or whatever. And Mom and I are sitting there visiting, and she says, "You know, I had a dream today that you brought my son a Mr. Potato Head game."
That's incredible.
Now, here's the thing that's so odd about it. The son had never asked me for it. I never had heard him mention it. I had never even thought of the game or the toy. Like I say, it went back when I was a kid, back in the late 50s, and it was such an unusual toy. If she had said, "I dreamed you brought him a soccer ball or a baseball cap,"
yes,
or something, it's too odd. What I'm curious about, what Dean, I would like his reaction, is where did the dream originate from, and why whoever originated picked such an unusual item that I would be bringing him. But this is too quick. I take with a grain of salt a lot of times if I call my mom on a Sunday afternoon and she says, "Oh, I knew that was you," because, heck, she's 92 in a nursing home. Who else is going to be calling her? But this is just too many specifics, I think.
Yeah, I agree that if you have something of that level of specificity that is something that doesn't arise with any frequency, and the other person also reports it and basically never reports it also, then that's probably a genuine case of telepathy. The question is, why did Mr. Potato Head come up? As it turns out, that in my book, I talk about Mr. Potato Head in the context of talking about why scientists don't like to deal with these things very much. They either consider something like telepathy to be a hot potato, or meaning something that they don't want to touch because it's too hot, or Mr. Potato Head, in which case it's like a toy, and they don't consider it to be something serious. So that's my own little addition to Mr. Potato Head.
Okay, is that good enough for you, Bill?
That's great, George. Thank you so much.
Okay, appreciate you calling the program. Next up, we'll go to our first-time caller line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George and Dean. Doing good tonight?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I got a real quick story here and just the Dean's thoughts on it. I was in a living room with two friends, and we had a conversation without speaking to each other. And I don't know if they let me in or if they've been doing this for a while, but we don't really talk about it out like verbally. It's something that we really don't talk about because you lose the feeling of it. But we had a conversation. We were all watching TV, and the room was silent except for the TV, and my mind was at ease, not really talking to myself or anything, just paying attention to the TV. And my friend Dave says, "Hey, Dave, how you doing?" And I entertained the idea, and I just, well, I'm doing, you know, in my head I spoke. And I said, "Well, I'm doing good." And we kind of just, the three of us had a little conversation in the room, in our minds to each other. And one time me and Dave were walking, and he stopped walking to tie his shoe. I didn't notice, but I actually physically felt him leave my presence. Like, I felt like I was actually alone. And with me, Dave, and Kevin, we're really connected like that. So Dean, what's that called? And are there any other, my question is, are there any exercises for the mind that you could do to strengthen a bond or a tie between other minds?
Was this something that happened once, or did it happen on numerous occasions?
Real strongly once, and if we're crossing the street, I don't have to look to see if cars are coming, as long as one of us is looking, because he communicates, you know, it was just the once that it was actually, like, the communication, as in, like, words being spoken, like, it's like listening to the unsaid is how I call it.
And were you imbibing in certain recreational chemicals at the time?
We were watching TV, but...
I mean, were you in an ordinary state of awareness, or had you taken something like a psychedelic drug? There are certain drugs, ayahuasca being one, psilocybin is another, LSD to some extent, in which there are stories of extremely strong telepathic rapport among people. In fact, in at least one of these drugs, the translation from the Amazon Indian name of it is telepathine, because it produces such a strong sense of telepathy. I'm aware of only one experiment that has, in a telepathy experiment with psilocybin, which was done in Amsterdam, to see whether or not it actually does improve a telepathic rapport, and it appears that it does. So it's always difficult when working with psychoactive substances because you don't know whether it's a hallucination or not. But given the one experiment that I do know, it is conceivable that these drugs are able to open the mind in a way that is you can't sustain in an ordinary state of mind. And that's the answer to your question.
Do we know how the drugs work, Dean, on the mind like that?
Well, yeah, there's something known about what happens to the brain chemistry, but my guess is that what's happening is that it destabilizes our sense of self. And if you do that, if you take your ordinary sense of their personal ego and you allow it to spread out a little bit into people around you, then the actual state of yourself, which is actually spread out, you can feel that. You can feel it spreading out into the people who are nearby.
Well, we know the shamans have done this for a long time.
That's what those drugs, that's what they came from.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let's go next to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi. I have a question on how interconnectedness relates to the theory of luck. Good luck, bad luck. For example, I am a dirt magnet. And I even bought a book on how to change your luck, and my dog ate it. So I was just wondering if there's something that, you know, everything balances out. Some people are lucky, some people are unlucky.
Some people have this cloud over their head all the time. Huh?
Oh, this big black cloud. So I was just wondering, can you really go to the other side and experience good luck instead of bad luck by this interconnectedness, or what's going on?
I would say that if bad luck is truly consistent, then yes, that is related in some way, probably to your intention.
Mm-hmm.
If your intention or your expectation is that you're going to experience sequences of negative events, then sure enough, you can attract that to yourself.
Because I've tried all that positive thinking and get back what you put out and mm-hmm. trying to be a good person and all that, but it's like I'm surrounded by people with good luck, so I got to be the counterweight and absorb the bad luck.
And sometimes all that positive thinking doesn't work for some reason. I don't know why, Dean.
Well, yeah. We are partially in control of our conscious thoughts, but not completely. We have a bunch of unconscious stuff going on as well. So... this becomes a job for a psychotherapist to explore what's the underlying reasons for why we may be self-defeating.
when I was doing my local show in St. Louis, Dean, my producer, Howard, I would always say he had a cloud over his head because, you know, everything he did, something would go wrong for him, poor guy. And I swear to God, we went out one day out of this plaza that we broadcast from, and it was raining, but only on him. You know how sometimes, you know, side of a street rains, but the other side doesn't?
Yeah.
Well, in this case, he was getting rained on. No one else was. It was just bizarre. Talk about synchronicity. Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Keith from Olympia.
Hi, Washington. Keith. Go ahead.
I have a lot of like telepathic things that actually happened to me quite a bit, and I kind of wanted to share one and kind of get your spin on it.
Okay, one we'll have time for.
Okay. There was a point that I owned a land gaming shop where all these kids would come in and they'd sit down at the computers and they'd play video games and they'd pay us a rate for it. And this one kid would come in that would just bug me. He was very loud and boisterous and he was kind of a pain. And I was having issues with him and he after having words with him, he sat down at the computer and he put his headphones on. And I sat down at my computer and I put my headphones on and I was thinking to myself some pretty unpolite things about the kid. And he got up and he took his headphones off. And he looked at me and said, "Now what'd you say?" And I, you know, the kid's like, "I didn't say nothing, dude." And the kid that was sitting next to me, that was sitting between the two of us, said, no, man, he didn't say anything. You know, sit down. And that was the end of that issue. You know, that was the end of that. But things like this seem to happen to me actually quite a bit. And I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Reaction, Dean Radin?
Well, it's conceivable, especially when having strong negative thoughts about somebody, that perhaps your body language or your facial expressions were projecting. So, in other words, it's not necessarily telepathy. It's just it's the way that people interact in nonverbal ways. On the other hand, if it was something specific that he picked up, like a particular word or something that would have been unusual, then you'd be more confident that it was something like telepathy.
Right.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. I don't know. I think one day, Dean, the more and more we get close to this, you know, I think we're going to find out that this was all by design, that it was supposed to be this way, because to me it doesn't happen, you know, by luck. It doesn't happen by chance. There's something behind this.
Mm-hmm.
And what a day that will be.
That is certainly the story that the mystics tell. I mean, part of the unity experience that they have is one where everything is fitting together exactly right. It's like one big jigsaw puzzle with lots of pieces, but they all fit in exactly the right way. And that's a pretty universal experience that is talked about. And it makes you wonder, well, what is really going on? What is it that they're experiencing that provides this level of unity that they're talking about?
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast in the waning minutes of the show. Hi there.
Hi. I'm a skeptic, as a matter of fact. But I took – you had a psi test on your website.
Right.
I'm not sure if you're familiar. I'd imagine you are. And there were five cards. And you'd pick the five cards, out of the five cards, what the picture would come up.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting is that I'd narrow it down, and like I say, I'm a skeptic, and I scored 23%, which is statistically, I'd imagine, average out of five cards.
Mm-hmm.
You get the 20% right. But what was interesting was I would narrow it down to two cards, and I'd be like, it's either the number one card or the number three card. And I'd pick the number three card, and the number one card would come up. I'm like, dag, you know, I'm getting upset.
Mm-hmm.
I know, like I say, I'm a skeptic. And so I shouldn't be getting irritated about this because I'm scoring 23%, my statistical average. But I was getting upset because I could have gotten that one because I had it down to one of two cards.
You still a skeptic?
And I don't know. How can I get better?
Well, by talking of yourself as a skeptic, it means that there's a certain part of you that doesn't really want to do very well.
Firewall in his system somewhere.
Yeah. And so if you can actually narrow it down to two cards and consistently choose it in such a way that you're actually ending up close to chance, it suggests that somewhere inside you, you actually do know what the right answer is, and you're selecting the other one.
Is he fighting it?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, some people are frightened by it or have other reasons why they would rather not see these things occur.
Next up, east of the Rockies. Let's see if we can squeeze you in here. You're on Coast to Coast.
Hello. I'm not trying to knock down your work because I've been sort of involved in similar lines, but there is something I need to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
How are your computers isolated from everything so that you can establish that you're definitely not reading electromagnetic interference?
Are you talking about the Global Consciousness Project?
You're talking about these random generators.
Right.
If we know that a electroencephalograph is pretty
sensitive,
marginal, if the subject and the equipment aren't isolated.
Right.
Now, what are your computers connected to, and what are they powered by? Because if they're connected to other things, and if they're powered by shared power that are powering other machines, then I have some. I think you need to do a little work on isolation.
Well, we'll find out. A minute to go, Dean. Go ahead.
Okay, so the computers are running off of uninterruptible power supplies, so it's ultimately battery power, although the UPS is connected to the line. But more importantly, the random generators themselves, as electronic circuits, are inside metal boxes. So they have Faraday cage-like protection against electromagnetics. And I could go in more detail. I don't have time to...
But the bottom line, Dean, you folks have taken precautions to avoid exactly what he said.
Yeah. We've looked at electromagnetic interference in great detail, and that's not a sufficient explanation.
Dean, keep in touch with us, especially if you see some spikes on these eggs. I'd be very interested to get you back on, even if it's for a quick news blip on just something that you're sensing, okay?
Okay.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Dean Radin, and his websites, of course, are linked at coasttocoastam.com. But to get his new book, Entangled Minds, for $1, www.ions.org. For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, Ross Mitchell, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Be safe, everyone.